And we need a more ambition from the government to achieve more renewables target, which also impacts to the people, which also will provide positive externalities to people, not only creating the negative externalities alone.
Stay tuned di ISR Bicara Energi.
Hello Sobat Essentials, welcome to 2&2 Conversations on Energy Transition. I am Martha, a Social and Economy Analyst from IESR, Institute for Essential Services Reform from Indonesia. I'll be your host and moderator for today's conversation. So, today we have a very exciting discussion lined up for us. We will have 4 esteemed guests that will share their knowledge and experience on challenges and benefits of the energy transitions across countries in this world. And as we know, energy transition has taken place across the globe, a multifaceted shift towards more sustainable economy and energy system. It is motivated by the imperative to mitigate the climate crisis, so we should decrease our reliance to the fossil fuels, and it could be done with various type of strategies, including efforts to increase the renewables to our power system and also supports the clean technology innovations. However, as we know, the context and trajectories of the energy transitions varies across countries because of the differences of these of the resources, the policies, and also the socioeconomic conditions. So we can understand that while the benefits of energy transitions exist, for example, improvement of quality of life, more decentralized job opportunity, or like the greener environment exist, the challenges because of energy transitions is also present and need to be solved, especially here in the global south, for example, in Indonesia. So these 2&2 conversations aim to highlight those stories, to unfold the stories of 2 challenges and 2 benefits from various countries across the globe. And it is very very important for us to understand that benefits and challenges coexist regarding the context of energy transition agenda. Joining me today, all virtually, 4 guests. They will share their knowledge and experience from each of their country where they are being part of or represent. So let me introduce all the guests today. First up, we have Mr. Ubaid Ur Herman Zia, an energy policy analyst and head of energy unit at Sustainable Development Policy Institute from Pakistan. We also have Mr. Muhammad Mustafa Amjad, power manager at Renewable First, also from Pakistan. Joining us here also Mrs. Michelle Lingham, owner of Solar Power Cafe in South Africa. And last but not least, we have Mr. Wira Agung Swadana, Green Economy Program Manager from IESR, Institute for Essential Services Reform from Indonesia. Welcome everyone, how are you? You can say hi to the guests and to the viewers here. Okay, I hope you guys really have a nice day in your countries, and thank you very much for making time for these sessions. And we'll hopefully this podcast or like this conversation will like watch by so many people there, and we can like bring our message and then listen, learn from our each our country. So without wasting any more time, please let me ask the first questions to each of our guests here. So how does the energy transition looks like in your country? And I really like to hear these answers, the story from each one of the guests here. So we can start from Miss Michelle. How does the energy transition look like in South Africa?
Thank you very much for the opportunity and the lovely presence this morning of everyone. So I'm in the solar industry as an EPC. So we are installing solar systems, and we started out in 2014. I established the Solar Power Cafe in 2017, looking at the different needs and requirements from a residential perspective, and then going all the way to commercial perspective. So when I was looking at the questions in preparation, the first thing I thought of, there's actually two sides to this question, especially in the context of South Africa. So I've looked at it from a pollutant perspective, because that's normally what you associate with a just energy transition. But then I also looked at the perspective of energy access. So we've got heavy industries in South Africa. We've got a lot of coal mining, gold mining, platinum mining. We have heavy manufacturing industries as well. And the association with them is always that they are large job providers, but they're also large polluters. So one of the things that I thought of as well is that we're always talking about, especially in our discussions on the business side as well, is what is the push for a just energy transition when most of your heavy polluters need to quickly scale and move over to renewable energy solutions when they're not possibly able to do so at a very rapid deployment pace? And also, how do we look at loss of jobs? Obviously, from a business perspective, we are always very focused on job creation. We don't want to take jobs away from people. So how do we work along with industries in order to change the skill base and also ensure minimal loss of jobs? Then on the other side of the coin, we look at a lot of rural areas still in South Africa that have no access to energy whatsoever. So in that case, the just energy transition does not mean that they're trying to reduce pollution, but actually to have an electrical connection. So one of the issues that we do face is the cost of grid connection and reaching long distances for substations. So that's why mini grid solutions, 10 megawatt, 5 megawatt, these sorts of solutions are things that are going to be benefiting people in those areas, and it's easy to deploy. Obviously, solar is the quickest to deploy versus wind, for example. And the benefit there is obviously that there's an improvement of quality of life, because for the first time, people are able to pump water. There's lights. The schools don't need to be in the dark. There's a lot of problems that exist in terms of crime as well. So just having lighting alone makes a big difference. So when I look at this question of a just energy transition as a business person, it's one, job creation, minimal job loss, and then also the upskilling of people in order to ensure that they are ready for these new technologies that are coming after we've used fossil fuel-based solutions for decades. Thank you.
Ms. Michelle, for the overall elaborations of how the energy transitions currently in South Africa. But actually, I have like some questions also to Ms. Michelle. So as an owner, like from the business perspective, how does the progress of energy transitions really drive or like encourage the business sector, and how is your company's actually doing or contributing to the renewables deployment?
Thank you. So just by virtue of, I would say, timelines between 2014 and 2024, the proliferation of solar companies, engineering companies that have started, people coming from the heavy industry who have also, I want to say, pivoted into going into renewables and solar has literally, I want to say, almost exploded. Like the amount of events, the amount of suppliers that we have, the amount of support that we have. There's government incentives even for taxation now as well, which previously we didn't have. Even on the residential side, we've had a tax benefit for residential clients who are installing solar systems. So I think also, you know, I want to say almost as South Africans, there's always a negative connotation towards what government is not doing. But as business people, we're always looking at what does work. So I work along with, okay, what is working? And just by the sheer number of companies that have started, and also I would say in terms of our contribution as a company, besides just putting down the solar system and installing something, you also need to look at how are you going to take care of this installation. So operations and maintenance is exceptionally important as well. So when you are looking at, okay, here's the solution, and then you just leave it there, you also need to maintain it. So that's something that I also really want to highlight, is not only that as businesses that we put down the solar system, but that we also look after it. There's sufficient training that goes into either your client and the people that is going to be utilizing the system, that they understand how to use it. So I would say that besides providing electricity, I'm also indirectly providing education to the clients who are using it. And obviously, word of mouth referrals for us to get more business and things like that, growing our business, comes from the fact that our clients understand. They want to be involved in understanding. So the factory owner doesn't just say anytime that something's going wrong or there's an error, that he says, okay, no, I don't know what's going on here. So I'm also seeing with clients themselves that they are starting to take an interest in understanding the various solutions as well. So that's sort of my take on that.
Okay, thank you so much. Very interesting stories from South Africa. And let's move to the Pakistans. So, Mr. Ubaid, can you tell us how the energy transition look like in Pakistan?
Yes, thank you so much, first of all, to ISR for inviting us here to this podcast. I think it's a wonderful discussion, a wonderful introduction, and Michelle has highlighted some very good points. So, I mean, looking at Pakistan itself is very heavily dominated by the imported fossil fuels as an energy source that has actually created significant challenges for the country. Even if you look at the excess number, the country, almost 23% of the population does not have access to a reliable grid electricity. I mean, 94% does have access to any form, but when we talk about the reliable grid electricity access, that's currently very lacking portion in Pakistan. So I think when we actually talk about energy transition or the just energy transition, which Michelle, I think, just recently quoted to, what needs to be done and what the energy transition should look like is that the people and community needs to be at the center of every development policies and plans. So let me sort of try to explain it in a context or giving an example of a very recent socioeconomic crisis of which the country is going through. So I think over the past 4 to 5 years, Pakistan, like many other developing countries, has actually gone through a very tough socioeconomic crisis resulting from COVID-19, climate-induced disasters, regional turmoil such as the Ukraine-Russia crisis, and a lot of other key aspects that actually happened over the past few years. So, along with various different impacts, what it has actually done is that it has actually exposed Pakistan's vulnerability of Pakistan's energy sector to different external shocks. So the point is that the country is going through an uncertain phase, and a very strong policy and regulatory support is actually required to go towards the path of that ensures a just and equitable transition. I'll just highlight some of the policy side. I think Mustafa can later come in and highlight other details as well. So what actually happened over the since 2019 is that because of such a high import reliance, the energy prices in Pakistan have substantially increased by over 100%. Previously, the government used to control these prices through different subsidies. However, since 2022, Pakistan even had to remove the subsidies to comply with the conditions imposed by the International Monetary Fund, IMF.
So all these issues that actually led to very unaffordable prices, not only for the people, but also for the manufacturing and industrial sector, which eventually dried out, and leading to unemployment and etc. So now what actually needs to actually happen when we actually bring the community perspective at the center is that, so I think I can just touch upon two quick points. I'll very quickly touch on the demand side management and some interventions that can actually happen on the supply end. So on the demand end, I think when we actually talk about affordability of the energy, one thing that obviously needs to happen is to come up with necessary regulations and reforms measures that can address the energy efficiency and conservation measures. But for a comparatively more vulnerable community, so we need to actually come up with some different social protection schemes that would be for households such as, I mean, Pakistan has actually had gone through the Benazir Income Support Program. Such schemes can actually be expedited through targeted subsidies to replace inefficient appliances and come up with some different advanced technologies for those communities. Then there's always discussion about different social safety nets and protection schemes in Pakistan that must be further expanded to what should call some non-standard beneficiaries that cannot actually afford energies at very high prices. And both the, I think Michelle also sort of touched upon this point that both formal and informal industrial sector also needs to sort of keep the employment at the center of the economic recovery plan, which Pakistan is actually, going through. So, I mean, sort of to ensure smooth functioning, the policy as well as the fiscal support provided to these industries, it has to actually sort of remain consistent. At the same time, I think just very quickly touching upon the fact that, I mean, when we are actually talking about just transition, then energy actually has a very strong nexus with the food sector. So the same economic recovery plan which we're actually talking about must also support the local stakeholders in agri-food supply chain to access these long-term financing for renewable energy-based solutions, such as the solar panels are there, the pumps are there, there are different buying mechanisms can be actually be used. Now, the second angle when we actually talk about the supply side is definitely the most obvious solutions to Pakistan's energy crisis is, especially in the light of the recent regional turmoil, is to switch from the fossil fuels towards renewable energy solutions sooner rather than later. So now there are very multiple aspects over here. Firstly, it's the distributed generation. Pakistan already has a very good story around these mini micro hydropower plants with the community-driven renewable energy solutions have actually proved to be very cost effective for the increasing electricity access and socially uplifting these communities. But the challenge what these solutions actually face is the lack of technical knowledge and capacity. There are also social and gender issues as well. So for such areas, what the government needs to do is to work with different local departments or the provincial departments to pilot these innovative business models for the last mile and energy service delivery. Further, I think there's also a very dire need that CSOs can actually, engage with different development partners or think tanks or international organizations to sort of come up with different technical assistance programs that aim to develop the capacity of these different communities. And I think also to fully realize the potential, the renewable energy industry must also ensure the inclusion of very widely underrepresented women in the energy sector's labor force and decision making as well. So again, I think just to initially touch upon the things, this is how the energy transition plan should look like, but definitely on the policy side, I'll just be ending with one more point is that we actually need to bring the consistency in our policy formulation and policy targets, because at the moment, what the major challenge for Pakistan is attracting the financing. Once the consistency is not there, that's actually going to remain a very big challenge. Yeah, so I think for the initial remarks, this is more or less fit from my end. So much, back to you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ubaid. It's very rich elaborations and from what is really happening on the energy transition in Pakistan. But maybe Mr. Mustafa, you can add some points. I will also maybe try to specify the questions because you guys are from the same country, from Pakistan. I would like to know more about the technical current technological conditions of the supply side of the energy system in Pakistan, and how does the current conditions maybe can be a challenge to shift towards more renewable energy sources? And then how does the policies currently maybe encouraging or maybe like, as Mr. Ubaid said, still lack of the consistency to support the renewable? So maybe you can add some elaborations on that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Martha, for your question. I guess Ubaid has already laid down the work for me, so it makes much of very easier to, you know, build on top of it. So I work with renewables first. We are a dedicated energy transition think tank, and we work through data-driven research, advocacy, capacity, network building to accelerate this transition. So we get to, you know, experience a lot of different perspectives. So before I go into how the journey looks like for Pakistan, I want to highlight how it should look like for Pakistan. And that becomes all the more important because essentially that is what we are driving towards. And there is, you know, increasing cognizance amongst the masses as well of what is required in a just energy transition. Ubaid rightly pointed out that the nature of this energy transition is such. Again, this isn't the first energy transition that the globe is going through. We've had various transitions in our history. Only this time around, people have to be at the center of it, because essentially there is the looming threat of climate change at the back that is, you know, acting as the reason that we are going through this energy transition. For Pakistan, that threat is very real. Obviously, climate change is a threat multiplier. Pakistan is pretty vulnerable. We are sixth most vulnerable in terms of, you know, global climate risk index. We've had climate change is manifesting in Pakistan through, you know, successive floodings every other year, erratic rainfall patterns, you know, droughts, seasonal variations in, you know, weather patterns. All of it is materializing in Pakistan. Even a couple of years back, we had half of the country was almost inundated by floods. So the people do understand that, you know, change is required. And that is where I think this energy transition becomes all the more important. For Pakistan, the ambition might be there. So while forget about, you know, tripling renewable energy capacity, Pakistan is one of those countries that intends to, you know, almost 5x its RE capacity by 2030. We are somewhere around the 6% VRE capacity in our mix right now, but we intend to, you know, take it to 30% by 2030. But then again, what is the major crisis is that, you know, we have to make sure that this is not a zero-sum game, but a positive-sum game. And we have to make sure that, you know, we minimize the negative impacts and, you know, maximize the positive opportunities. So what it essentially means is that the mistakes that we did or the norms that we established for, you know, fossil fuel mining, for the old power systems, for the old energy mechanisms, that doesn't have to be the same in this new energy systems. So what it means is communities need to be incorporated, distributed generations need to be, you know, mainstream, democratization of power needs to be ensured, power systems should be such that people are at the center of that, energy access should be ensured, energy affordability should be there, you know, land rights, indigenous rights, you know, human rights should be kept sacrosanct in this whole process. And that is why I think Pakistan's this very nascent energy transition journey becomes very unique, you know, compared to, say, other global north countries or, you know, even within Southeast Asia or South Asia. Because the threat of climate change is very real. And like you said, Pakistan is very uniquely placed because we do have a lot of renewable energy resources. So when we talk about, you know, wind and solar, we are blessed with different weathers across the year. We are blessed with four different seasons. Excellent solar radiation is available across the country. We have wind corridors close to load centers. So the renewable energy resources are there. It's about how does Pakistan, you know, essentially get those enablers for an energy transition sorted out. So when I say enablers, I essentially mean financing, I essentially mean supply chains, I essentially mean, you know, grids, because again, given the geopolitical situation of the country, the grids, cross-border trade of electricity is not an option. So the grids have to be a self-sustainable model, and that comes with its own set of challenges. Renewable energy has different properties, including, you know, location constraints, including different form of plannings. They're more modular. That essentially means that, you know, a revamped system is required, and that system would need investments at a local level, you know, be it in terms of communities, at a provincial level, and then at the national level as well. So all of these investments need to come through, and this would require a lot of financing. As Obed rightly mentioned, Pakistan is going through somewhat a macroeconomic crisis right now. While investors do realize that this is a good market to be in, they're very skeptical given the high risk, given the political uncertainty, given the macroeconomic conditions. So all of these factors need to be aligned. All of this needs to be worked on to essentially ensure that the energy transition journey can be accelerated in the country. Doesn't mean that it's not doable. It's just that, you know, all of these challenges present more opportunities for us to work in, and I think the elements of justice kind of also dictate that, you know, all of this needs to be done in a manner that is, you know, both in line with the global goals that we have set out around, you know, 1.5C future, but also ensuring that in doing so the people of Pakistan are kept central to the planning and the new electricity system or the energy system that we establish.
We can understand in Pakistan they have very rich potentials of renewables, but maybe there's a need to enhance the enablers, the policies, like the financing instruments and all the derivative measures to enhance and drive more deployment of renewables. But lastly, also Mr. Mustafa mentions about how also important to improve the public ambitions and engagement to the public in Pakistan. And I would like to know more about it. Maybe Mr. Mustafa, you can tell us about how the social and economic impacts really happening throughout the process of energy transitions, or maybe like the renewables deployment in Pakistan.
Like Michelle also laid out, so there are different elements to the deployment of renewables. So it's either going to be at the grid level or it's going to be at the community level. While the grid level obviously requires a lot more government interference, a lot more government ambition, people have decided that, you know, renewable energy is the way to go. And there are multiple reasons for it. There's the question of energy access. There's the question of energy affordability. And then the looming threat of climate change. So obviously, while the country was inundated by floods, people were looking out for solutions of, you know, getting cheaper, cleaner, renewable energy for their electricity needs, for their energy needs. And this has been materializing. Like Obed said, even in coal-dominated regions, even in coal-producing regions, coal power plants, you visit those areas and you would see people on bicycles with a solar panel attached at the back of it. And, you know, they'll be charging their phones with a said solar panel. And you'll be there. And that's the kind of innovation that needs to be mainstreamed, essentially. I think, and that is kind of the success of the energy transition journey as well, that people understand that this is what our needs are, this is our requirements, and the government just has to play as a facilitator in ensuring that these business models are established, they are mainstreamed, this indigenous knowledge is, you know, spread across the country. It has to act as an enabler to ensure that the needs of the people are essentially met. So I'm talking, again, this is a very people-centric approach, talk about industry. All of the export-oriented industry is demanding clean energy. They have to resort to, you know, renewable energy certificates. They're looking at setting up their own renewable energy plants, because essentially that allows them new markets to, you know, explore, particularly after the implementation of CBAM, carbon border adjustment mechanism in Europe as well, that would also limit a lot of, you know, exports to such countries as well. So all of that in mind, I think the demand is there. It's just that like I said, that the macroeconomic conditions are as such, or the enablers are as such, that essentially a whole transformation is required. A transformation of the grid, a transformation of financing mechanisms, of policies, of thinking amongst the policies policymakers, experts that are not aware of, you know, the new paradigm shifts of new systems, all of this unlearning and learning that needs to be done essentially at different levels of the community, of the policy paradigms. All of that needs to happen. And that's where this journey needs to be accelerated in terms of energy transition. But if we talk about demand, I think that is there and that is going to only accelerate as, you know, climate change continues manifesting in the country.
I see. Thank you so much. Very powerful stories from Pakistan. So the demand is there, but like the enablers and like policies needs to enhance also to make like the optimum conditions of energy transition and renewables deployment. Next, we also want to know about Indonesia context. So we have Mr. Wira here with us. Mr. Wira, could you please elaborate or like tell us the story about how does the energy transition look like in Indonesia?
Okay, thank you, Martha, for the first question. I found like this is a very interesting question to see like exactly how the landscape of renewables energy in Indonesia. One of the things that we need to focus on is on the macro level. And the macro level, the government has already achieved 13 to 14% of renewables energy, which is still far from the target. The target alone is supposed to be like 17 to 19% by 2023. But, and by 2025, the target should be 23%. But the thing is, the government doesn't have any ambition to, or it doesn't really reflect their ambition to the current statement. Because what's the situation is, the government aims to even reduce the renewables target by 2025 into 17 to 19%, which is still far from what the government wanted to have, right? But regardless of having this situation, we also need to look at the energy transition at the people level. Why is it very important? Because without energy transition, when we still rely on fossil fuel, we think that there are lots of negative externalities to the people. One of them is the health benefits that cannot be achieved until nowadays. Why is that so? Because the target of the CREA and also ISR study in 2023 shows that. The study shows that 174 trillion rupiah has become the need for the government to focus on energy transition and also for the health impact in these coal-fired plants. And we think that is a big amount of money that the government needs to pay on. And we think not only that alone, in the mining sites, there are lots of negative impacts because of lack of ambition of the energy transition and the people. We think, looking at this landscape, we see that Indonesia has not been becoming a better ambitious country to achieve the target alone. And we need a more ambition from the government to achieve more renewables target, which also impacts to the people, which also will provide positive externalities to people, not only creating the negative externalities alone. And therefore, what we need to have is that a lot of work still become the homework for Indonesia to show that the country has become a better country to for renewables energy and for the climate and also for the people.
Mr. Wira, I would also like to know how is the like local context in South Africa? How is the coal producing region in South Africa really give the evidence of how people benefited from energy transition? So Michelle, can you also tell us the stories?
I think this is something that I learned probably 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I listened to a discourse from the presidency when we were at the Key Energy Transition Conference in Italy. And we have a coal producing region called Mpumalanga, where there's a lot of mining activity. Sasol is based there. They one of the top five polluters also, but also a very large job provider once again. And they have got a roadmap within the presidency specifically for that area as well, because of the popularity of the use of coal due to the region. First of all, for upskilling, and second of all, to reduce and to completely minimize job loss, because 80% of the people in that area are skilled for the mining industry. And what they've started with, they've started, I think the first plant sizes were from 5 megawatt or 10 megawatt upwards. I don't quite remember. But from a government perspective, they've realized that there's a need to transition to much cleaner technologies. And I know that the deployment of the solar has been first. I don't know too much about what they're doing on the wind side. But in terms of solar, they're generating a lot of clean power there now at the moment. And I'm not sure if I mentioned earlier on, we only have one major power utility, which is Eskom. And at the moment, there are a lot of infrastructure problems within the utility. So the prevalence of independent power producers is starting to take place, and power purchase agreements where companies and manufacturing industries are buying their power independently. So I would say there's a push now from government, which previously we didn't have. And it was interesting to note, which I went and heard it in Italy, I haven't even heard it yet in South Africa, that there's a push from the government to say, okay, we understand. Previously, there were lobby groups, you know, the green people, everybody seems quite annoying, but they were actually giving out very important information. And now that the problems are being experienced, now there's a change. And obviously, when you're working from a government perspective, the implementation time is much shorter. It's not like in private sector where we can turn around very quickly. So when they say they've got a 5 to 10 year roadmap, that's pretty much what you're going to look at. So I would say that there's a lot of positive change. Obviously, business people always see opportunities, and we see the positive spin on things. We don't only see what's wrong. So what I see is definite change. And like I say, from 2014 to now, it's a different landscape altogether.
Okay, very interesting. So the positive change is really evidenced in South Africa also. But Ms. Michelle, can you also elaborate more on the health benefits maybe of the people, the community around fossil fuel industries? Because nowadays we know that fossil fuels really impact the quality of our lives, including our health, because like the pollutions there and like the environmental degradations. So is there also any stories about how renewables and like cleaner renewable sources can also benefits also influence the greater health of the people or the community around regions?
Okay, I can comment on that very briefly because I don't have too many facts on it from what I know very broadly. I think I mentioned we've got 3 to 5 top polluters in the country. And from the time that they've been polluting in the 80s and not taking action for how they actually produce certain things with chemicals being released into the air, especially like I grew up in Secunda where Cecil is in Mpumalanga, and most of the children always had respiratory problems. And because of the push also from government penalties that have had to be paid, they've also had to improve on their processes for how they're going to manufacture and also how can they make their processes much cleaner. So overall, I do know also that they run community programs. They are running health programs also to check on at a not a primary school level. What do you call it when the children are very small, when they're like toddlers, like preschool level, is doing health checks on them. Interventions that weren't there before, and it's being provided by these, I want to say, large scale polluters. But that's as much as I know. I don't have too many facts on that, so I don't want to comment too much, but that's what I know broadly.
Thank you so much. Very interesting. And we can also move to Mr. Ubaid. So as you mentioned earlier, so the financing is a very big concerns to like to the process of like from the demand side of energy transitions also. And I think it's very closely related to the market mechanism or like pricing happening in Pakistan. And could you please elaborate how the financing is going in Pakistan, and what is the bigger contributor of financings in renewables? Is it like the international organizations or like private sectors or like maybe the government itself?
Yeah, okay. So firstly, let me sort of brief that why financing in the renewable energy is a challenge, because Pakistan is actually, one of the many reasons is that Pakistan is actually suffering from the issue of overcapacity. The problem here is that Pakistan has the peak demands hovering somewhere at around 28,000 megawatts, even in the summer season, and in winter it even drops to 11,000 megawatt, but overall the capacity stands somewhere at around 43,000 megawatts. So a lot of power plants have to be idle, and the country's energy demand, industrial demand, is actually not growing, leading to some challenges which we actually face coming from some of the agreements just with the independent power producers we actually made. So any investments that come into renewable energy, because the focus which is currently needs to actually happen, it might not go a lot towards the generation side, but it actually go more towards the addressing the issues of the transmission and distribution, or addressing the issues at the demand side. If we actually talk about the challenges if we are going to invest in renewable energy, is that we cannot actually, it is actually challenging for Pakistan to transition away from its fossil fuels. There are a bundle of reasons. Let me just quickly highlight a few. That we have this long-term power purchase agreements with fossil fuel power plants. Even the coal power fleet of Pakistan, that's currently in a very young state. Even the oldest ones are, 6 to 7 years old, most of them. And these plants are also operating at good efficiency. They do have these legal covers and government guarantees as well. And it's a very sort of very financially tangled governance, or a very complex governing landscape that actually has to be addressed if Pakistan has to actually attract different financing mechanisms to address the solution, such as if we talk about the Just Energy Transition partnerships are a way is a sort of a mechanism that can actually be utilized to bring in investments into the renewable energy sector or divert the investments away from the fossil fuels. But the thermal, particularly the coal in Pakistan, has a very strong political bind from all of the ruling parties. And that's why it's actually one of the challenges. So now coming towards the question of where the investments are, they're actually okay. Now there are two funds again. If we talk about the public sector interventions, then the government of Pakistan did actually observe a somewhat well-documented shift in its policies that actually aims to build the capacity or build the share of renewable energy. Even Pakistan State Bank a few years back came up with the green financing scheme that can actually be used for renewable energy development. Definitely after this economic crisis, the scheme is not there. But for the on the off-grid systems, a lot of communities have done work by themselves as well. Pakistan has a whole province of Balochistan, which has a very limited access to grid-based electricity. What people have actually done is people have sort of come up in different community-based financial models, and they have sort of tried to establish these small grids are there. I initially pointed out the case of mini micro hydropower plants, and people have come up with really realistic, some very good different financing schemes through which they can actually run and bring electricity within their communities as well. Now, for the big power plants, when you talk about the most of the, financing has actually gone into the wind energy sector, and that's where the private sector has a lot of investments going on there. It's more of iniquity with financing also coming from different development partners, different financing institutions, but wind energy has actually developed. But again, the overall renewable energy capacity in Pakistan's total capacity share is, even if we combine solar and wind, it's roughly around 7%, I guess. So private sector has done some investments. There are no very big government-owned renewable energy power plants in Pakistan. And the communities themselves, they actually work towards attracting a lot of different financing models, which they have actually sort of tried to address their energy concerns and how they can actually make the energy prices affordable for them. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mr. Ubaid, for the answers. And Also, we want to know about the benefits or like positive impact from the Indonesia's country. And Mr. Wira, could you please tell the like evidence benefits of energy transition in Indonesia? As you mentioned before, the targets and like the progress is there, but concern about people is very important topics also. But how about the benefits? Please elaborate the current or like the evident benefits of energy transition in Indonesia.
On your second question, I think that it's very important to see the benefit of energy transition to the people by looking at the macro level. Why? We see that energy transition in the community has become the accommodation of access to energy transition to the people, which means that democratization of energy has still become the issue of Indonesia, but because of energy transition, that becomes a new avenue or even the new starting point for the people to have the access to energy, to the power, to the better electricity. But because of the current situation has not been accommodated, the community has started to create their own clean renewables energy transition for the people through, for example, in NTT, in East Nusa Tenggara, where the people have started to use micro hydropower to their community itself, or even mini solar PV for themselves, which is a good signal that community who started the energy transition has provided their own energy for their energy security. But second of those is energy transition also possesses a very important effect for the people, which is about the health impact. We know that energy transition in Indonesia has already caused a lot of damages, as previously mentioned, but because of energy transition, not energy transition, but fossil fuels, I mean. But because of energy transition, we found that there are lots of positive externalities that they itself impact to the people, affect to the people. For example, energy transition gives a lot of clean energy, less pollution in the city and urban area. But only that, in rural area, because of lack of extractive industries and lack of demand itself, there will be a lot of externalities where there will be a new avenue for the community to start their own a new economy for the community, which will affect to their multiplier effects, and which means that there are a lot of money that will be distributed more proportionately to the people compared to the current extractive industries that is still focusing on the money centralized in the company and also in certain parts of not only for the community itself. Therefore, we think that with the energy transition, it possesses a lot of advantages and opportunities for the betterment of the community and also for the energy access to the people as well.
Before we conclude everything, because very rich information and elaboration from our guests here today, I would like to give and to ask a concluding remarks from each one of you guys to give your like speech or like your stance on what is like the main challenge and how we can optimize the benefits of energy transitions and to the context of your local countries. Maybe we can start from Mr. Mustafa, please.
Yeah, thank you so much, Martha. So, Obed rightly mentioned, you know, the financing needs and the crisis that Pakistan is going through, and yes, we do have overcapacity, and obviously our coal fleet is very nascent. The average age of our coal fleet is almost 5 to 6 years. So keeping this in mind, there is a huge, you know, there is a huge responsibility of this journey to ensure that, you know, it is done in a way that it doesn't impact the people of Pakistan. Pakistan is already producing some of the most expensive electricity or power in the region. So it's almost approaching 14 to 15 cents per kilowatt hour. And the reason for that is the high, the contracts, the circular debt, capacity payments that we are accruing due to idle capacity power plants or thermal power plants that were set up either on RLNG and are not running due to, you know, expensive RLNG in the market after the Russia-Ukraine crisis. So all of these issues, all of these geopolitical challenges kind of make Pakistan all the more vulnerable in its energy transition journey. Renewable energy has to be front and center of this. Obviously, if we need to, our circular debt is almost approaching $20 billion USD now. And if we have to bring that down, that's almost, you know, 5 to 6% of our annual GDP rate. So if you need to bring that down, there is renewable energy as the only sole option. And the government does realize this. It's just that the macroeconomic situations are such that financing needs to be made available, different channels of financing, different risk mitigation factors to attract private finance need to be mainstreamed. And that is where I think the global community has a role to play as well. When we talk about energy justice, it's not only at a national scale, it's also energy justice between countries at a global scale as well. And I think the developed North and global North has you know, a responsibility for countries like Pakistan that are at the early stages of their energy transition journey to help ensure that, you know, de-risking mechanisms are provided, that financing avenues and channels and pipelines of renewable energy projects are set up and established. The will is there, obviously, but the enablers and all of the processes that need to be undertaken in ensuring a just energy transition, all of that needs to be worked upon. Obviously, in terms of the region, Pakistan might not be the laggard, but it definitely does have the potential to be a leader in the energy transition journey of the region. And I think all of that will be directly linked with our development objectives. And hopefully, as the situation improves on the political front, on the economic front, Pakistan will definitely be doing much better on the energy transition front as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Mustafa. Next, Ms. Michelle, please share some concluding remarks also.
Okay, so under the challenges, when I did the preparation, you know, I don't want to be too controversial, but it's things that I can't say because I'm in business. So I think it's something we find across the world. There's political corruption. There's resistance from politicians when it comes to change. We still have a very popular option in South Africa of diesel generators due to a lack of correct information. A lot of large-scale users, medium-sized power users, homeowners still want to buy a generator. And that's also due to a lack of, I would say, good education on renewable energy. So even though there is a shift towards understanding, that shift is still very slow. So there's still a perception in the minds of people that a solar solution, a battery solution is very expensive, but they don't look at the cost over time of running a diesel gen, for example. The other thing also that I wanted to mention is that there can be resistance from communities also. For example, when you're going to put down a mini grid. Why? Because the company that's installing is from Europe or from America, and they're all well known, and they're not even employing local people. So there has been resistance from the South African business community to say, okay, we've got the engineering skills in-house. Why are we importing the people as well? We don't need to. We've got the skills here in the country. Why do we need these European and American large-scale EPCs just doing the installing work? They don't do the training correctly for the after-sales maintenance, the aftermarket services. Everything has to go back to Europe or back to America. So that's one of the biggest challenges that we're facing also at the moment, is that there are essential skills that are needed, especially on larger projects that are simply not here, because the government still has the perception as well that the skills come from Europe. They're not actually in South Africa. We also recently had issues at the power utility where they got consultants from Italy, for example. So I've got nothing against that, but why are we not using South Africans? Because we are based here and we understand the context of our problem. So those are sort of the challenges that we're facing. And when it comes to the benefits and what is the hope, of course, because I'm an entrepreneur, I always see it, like I said earlier, on what is working. Besides power outages, besides cable theft, besides the scheduled load shedding that we call it, where sometimes you can be without power 12 hours for the day. What is the opportunity there? What are the benefits of us looking at something new? Is first of all, a willingness to understand, a willingness to change from decision maker's perspective, like I say, from a homeowner all the way to a factory owner. What is that willingness? Can we encourage the conversation more? Can we make the conversation more approachable and not just something that's there that we don't understand? So we stick to what we know. I think encouraging those conversations is important. And a very big thing for me also is really job training, job skills, upskilling, providing sustainable long-term jobs. It's not a six-month contract and, oh, I've provided jobs, and then afterwards the skills leave again to Europe or to America, or they've trained the people insufficiently. And I'm saying, no, that's not a sustainable job. A sustainable job is that person is there, they've got a permanent contract, they're going to work, they're going to improve, they're able to train the next person that comes in. So I take a very, I want to say, pragmatic and practical approach and not just this high-level view. It's like, no, how is this going to work in real life? And it's going to work by empowering people, number one, keeping sustainable jobs, because we have a very high unemployment rate in South Africa, and we have a high crime rate. And the two are sort of linked. So the more I have unemployed people, I also seem to have an increase in crime as well. So the improvement in the quality of life, the improvement in education, schooling is where we need to start. That should really be our starting point. And there's a lot of work to be done. And I really, you know, I want to conclude by saying that there's a lot of work that is, it's a positive change, because it's something that's sustainable and long lasting. It's not something that's just built for now for a few people to benefit from, but generations from now to benefit from. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Michelle. Next, we also want to hear the concluding remarks from Mr. Wira.
When we talk about energy transition, we talk about the new system. We talk about a betterment for the community, but it also needs just transition. In Indonesia, I think this is very important. Energy transition is accompanied with just transition principles. Why is that very important? Because just transition heals the previous and also existing wounds, and will also prevent a new wounds to be appear or emerge. We have seen that there are lots of community are being impacted because of fossil fuel energy. But with energy transition, we think that it's very important to try to heal the wounds, trying to impact to the people positively, looking at the environment, looking at the climate, looking at the economy, socioeconomic structures and systems. But what I think very important in the just energy transition or just transition is how exactly this is all for the people and for the environment itself. Indonesia has still lots of work for their energy ambition, but I think it is very important to also see that energy ambition itself should focus on the people, but not only on the number of the target. Not only the percentage, but looking at how exactly it will affect the people and for the community, and it will also affect the future generation. Because when we start the energy transition now with more ambition, we start the energy transition for future generation to have a better world and to have a more conducive situation, not being impacted by climate change and exacerbation. Therefore, I think this is very important to look at energy transition in the whole systematic level and comprehensive manner.
Thank you so much, Mr. Wira. And last but not least, Mr. Ubaid, please say your concluding remarks. Yes.
Thank you. I think I'll just conclude with one point that, I mean, the biggest or one of the major challenges in Pakistan is the policy and consistency. So what we need to do is bring consistency, bring reliability in your policy decisions, in your overall decisions, and sort of try to go with the global trend. I mean, because I mean, when we talk about renewable energy, it's not that. I mean, Pakistan doesn't have to go towards renewable energy because they're environment friendly. They have to go towards renewable energy because it makes a much better economic case. So because, I mean, what we are currently not able to perhaps sort of understand is that although the coal, Pakistan does have a lot of indigenous coal resources, but it might not be able to attract financing from the international community for its any further development. So we need to do something that goes in line with the global trends and renewable energy. A lot of financing mechanisms are available. Even the private sector wants to come in. Mustafa has very well captured that the demand for renewable energy is there, and this is primarily the reason. So perhaps we need to bring all of the decision making, provide an enabling environment for the private sector to again come in, because there again, I think Michelle has very well pointed out as well that they're actually going to come in when there is a consistency in the decision making as well, and when there's a policy consistency, when they do find that the environment present over there is actually friendly enough for them to sort of come and invest in. So, but this again requires building the capacity of all the relevant stakeholders in the supply chain, coming from the leading from the government, like how they have to attract different financing mechanisms. Private sector in itself has to play a very key role in all of this. So yeah, I think this just roughly ending on those points. Over to you, Patrice.
And I'm trying my best to conclude all the rich elaboration and informations of today's sessions. But one thing for sure, reflecting for the discussions today, that each country has their own unique context of their benefits and challenges. So it is very important to like locally understand what works for our country and like what is like the main challenge. And I'm write down here like points from our discussions today, that some challenges that found in Pakistan and also in South Africa, there are like issues on policy inconsistency, and also the financing and investment planning and implementation is also still a problem, and also the technological, and most importantly the political will and political ambitions of the government, also the main challenges also in countries. But also the public awareness is also needs to be enhanced from the basic current conditions. But also the benefits is very rich. We can see the evidence of like the improvement in quality of life. We can see the access of education and training is very helpful for people, and also their and the cleaner and greener environmental, and also the pollutions, the decreasing pollutions also influence their health, and also the employment opportunity, the decentralized job opportunity also is very beneficial evidence in South Africa, and also the chance to diversify the business and economy is a big opportunity also from the energy transitions. So it is very important to understand that energy transition may face some challenges, but also the benefit and the positive impacts of it is very huge also. And I think it's very important to continue the communications to make bigger space for the countries around the globe to communicate what is the local context, how is the strategy, how is like the policies there in each of their countries, so we can learn from each other and try to tailor our strategies that really relevant and really effective for our country. So maybe in the end, the idea of like locally solutions or local solution for global problems is still relevant, even for the energy transition topics. And it's very important to keep the ongoing communications of all actors and stakeholders worldwide going. And then the engagement among countries is also very important, so we can like learn and understand from each other. So I think that's a wrap for today's sessions. Thank you so much for joining us in 2N2 podcast, a conversations on energy transitions. And I want to thank our guest here. Thank you so much for your time, your knowledge you shared today. And I hope that next time we can also engage in another opportunity. Mr. Ubaid, Mr. Mustafa, Ms. Michelle, and Mr. Wira, thank you so much for your time, for sharing us your knowledge and experience in your countries. And see you next time, and goodbye.